you enjoy listening to WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook, we know you do because here you are, hearing Democracy Now! And tuning in for The Healthy Planet Radio. If you've been listening to this show or any of our programming for any period of time, you know how unique it is. You know how it means something. We teach you not only about how to stay alive and how to keep your family healthy, but we teach you how to contribute to the world in a way that cannot be overstated, because the world's solutions start with each and every one of us. And that's something you do not get when you listen to commercial radio programs. You get a lot of dribble, you get a lot of opinions, but you don't get in-depth information that makes you a better part of the solution. Well, now you have a chance to pay back, and you can do that by supporting WUSB Fall Radiothon. Our goal is $20,000, and the way we reach that goal is by you contributing. Call 631-632-6901. That's 631-632-6901, or 1-888-632-9872. 888-632-9872. You can also go to wusb.fm, pledge, and get premiums for your donation. You can get for $90.10, as in 90.1, a t-shirt and baseball cap. For $75, a sweatshirt. For $50, a t-shirt. These are all WUSB items, items that will identify you as a supporter of the most important radio station in Suffolk. $50, you get a t-shirt. $35, a baseball cap. And on and on. WUSB.fm or call 631-632-6901. 632-6901. You know we make a difference, and you know that we need you to continue doing this. Our volunteer hosts and DJs are doing 24/7 programming out of passion. But passion needs a studio, needs a transmitter, needs you. 631-632-6901. And now for our show. Welcome to this edition of The Healthy Planet radio program on WUSB 90.1 FM. My name is Bob DiBenedetto, your host for what you now know is the best hour of your life. That's right, the one that's always in front of you right now. The Healthy Planet focuses on topics that will help to educate you about the deep connection among all life on Earth and the powerful effects your everyday choices can have on creating a clean, healthy, and compassionate world. Now, tonight, without any further delay, I'm going to make use of every minute we have to begin our discussion with our special guest, Dr. Neil Barnard, MD, FACC of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, known as PCRM. For those of you listening to us on the air, what you don't know is this is our first live radio show. That means we have a live virtual studio audience. Unlike the radio shows that we've been doing since 2007 that were just on the air, this one has an audience. So if you're interested in being in this audience in the future, check out Healthy Planet USA on Facebook or Healthy Planet USA online. So our guest, Dr. Barnard, is an adjunct professor of medicine at the George Washington University
School of Medicine in Washington, D.C.,
and president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. He's led numerous research studies investigating the effects of diet on diabetes, body weight, and chronic pain, has authored more than 100 scientific publications and 20 books for medical and lay readers, and is the editor-in-chief of the Nutrition Guide for Clinicians, a textbook made available to all U.S. medical students. He's hosted 4 PBS television programs on nutrition and health, and his research contributed to the acceptance of plant-based diets in the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. Dr. Barnard has authored key resolutions, now part of the American Medical Association's policy, calling for a new focus on prevention and nutrition in federal policies and in medical practice. And in 2016, he founded the Barnard Medical Center in Washington, D.C., as a model for making nutrition a routine part of all medical care. Dr. Barnard, thank you so much for joining us on the Healthy Planet radio show.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you today.
All right. It's really a pleasure to have you with us this evening. And I've followed and appreciated your work and the work of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine for a few decades now. However, when going out on the radio, some of our listeners, many of whom will be driving home from work when they hear this show, might be hearing about you for the first time. That's despite the fact that you've been around and you've been quite active in education and research and writing, as I mentioned in your intro, and you have quite a following. So I'll preface our conversation by letting our audience know that when Dr. Barnard started PCRM in 1985, there were not a whole lot of doctors talking about the strong connection between our diet and our health. It was very different than it is today. And we started doing our nonprofit health and environmental education work in 1990. So I speak from experience. And with that said, I'd like to start out by acknowledging your decades-long history of getting it right, and by thanking you for so many years of consistent actions taken on behalf of not just the people you speak to, but everybody, whether they know about you or not. So thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you for saying that. I have to say, though, everything we're doing is very much a team effort. So we're all doing our bit together. And luckily, we're making some progress.
Absolutely. It's pretty clear that you have made a big difference in the world, but we'll be talking about some of that. Since the last 2 years have seen the world focusing on, obviously, the biggest public health story of our time, let's frame these first questions using COVID-19 as the context. It's become apparent that those with pre-existing, often lifestyle-related conditions from diabetes to cardiovascular disease, obesity, cancer, respiratory disease, and more are overall more likely to suffer from the most severe impacts of COVID-19. And of course, these are the very same conditions you, Dr. Barnard, have been researching and educating the public about for so many years. Now, there have been a couple of recent studies that show that a plant-based diet can perhaps significantly lower the risk of suffering from the most severe impacts of COVID-19, and maybe even reduce our risk of getting the disease in the first place. So, Dr. Barnard, I'm going to ask you first to tell me whether what I just stated is correct, and also discuss the findings, and then we'll talk a bit more about all the conditions that are behind COVID-19 and experiencing the more severe outcomes from that.
Sure. What you said is exactly right. Studies have really shown that diet does make a big difference. And this really shouldn't have been a surprise, because as soon as the virus emerged at the very beginning of 2020, it started in China, then it spread across Europe and so forth and came to North America. It was really clear that it was not exactly a democratic virus. In other words, it hit different people very differently. If you were in China and it's February or March of 2020 and the virus is spreading, if your weight was really low, in the healthy range, but kind of on the skinny side of healthy, your mortality was really low. If you were then through normal weight to a little bit overweight to really heavy, mortality went just right up. And then when the virus ended up in going through France, I remember researchers were saying there is something about extra body weight. When the virus comes in, it becomes a killer. And it wasn't just body weight. It was also hypertension, high lipid levels, lung disease. These were the underlying conditions that made it a killer. And so people started to speculate, all right, if that's the case, which demographic group has the healthiest body weight? Well, vegans, of course, are they're in the healthy range, but they're thinner than meat eaters, thinner than fish eaters, thinner than ovo-lacto vegetarians. So they ought to do better. But it took some time before researchers really had more data to speak with more confidence. And earlier this year, a couple months ago, a study came out that was conducted in 6 different countries, and they zeroed in on healthcare workers. And healthcare workers, like everybody else, vary in their diets. And what they found is that if you compare the people who are really, I mean, they wouldn't know a vegetable if they ate it, and you compare it to the people who are more or less plant-based, that latter group, the people who did know about vegetables and fruits and beans and whole grains, they had more plant-based diets, had a 73% reduced risk of severe COVID-19. So there was something about a plant-based diet that was really good.
That bears repeating. A 73% reduced risk of the most severe complications of COVID-19.
Yeah, that's right. And if you had let's say it was a fish-based diet.
Yeah.
Not quite as good. But if you were eating all kinds of meat, beef, pork, chicken, fish, everything else, and you reduced to just the fish, you would do better. But if you take the fish off your plate, you would do substantially better still, which is exactly the pattern that we saw with diabetes. More than 10 years ago, back in 2009, at the Adventist Health Study, they looked at who gets diabetes, who doesn't. And it was just a stair step down, meat eaters to occasional meat eaters, like less than once a week, they had a little bit of reduced risk of diabetes. Then people who ate no meat other than fish, they had reduced risk. People who were over lacto, reduced still. But what, to get to the bottom risk, these are the people who don't eat animal products at all. But the researchers went a step further, and I want to share this with you. Some people do fad diets. They do a ketogenic diet, which says don't eat apples because they have carbs in them, and don't eat bananas, and don't eat mangoes, and don't eat berries, and don't eat potatoes, and don't eat rice, all this kind of stuff. Those people did substantially worse. People following low carb diets in this study had about a 48, almost 50% increased risk of severe COVID. So that was really worrisome, but it didn't end there. There was a much bigger study. It was called the COVID symptom study. And this was a very cool study. As soon as the virus was emerging, researchers knew that not everybody who has symptoms is going to go to a clinic. They might be lost to follow-up. But we needed to see who's getting this virus, where is it spreading, who's connected to whom. So they set up the COVID symptom study and asked people, download this app and tell us about your potential symptoms of COVID and log on. They had almost 600,000 participants in an enormous study in the US and the UK. And so they were tracking their symptoms on their smartphone. And over time, more than 30,000 people developed COVID. And then they said, okay, what have you been eating? And what they found was, did you do a food frequency questionnaire? How often do you have meat? Do I have it every day? Do I have it once a week? Do I have it less than once a week? That kind of thing. How often do you have eggs? How often do you have green vegetables? Whatever. So they knew about their diets. And what they found, first of all, the likelihood of having any kind of COVID-19, mild, moderate to severe, among plant-based people was cut by 9%. Okay, not great, but we'll take it. But then they looked at the likelihood of having severe COVID, where you not only inhale the virus, but it slays you, 41% reduced risk in the plant-based group there in this study. So both of these studies suggest that even though this virus is out and about, it's looking for a home, you know, but this virus does not survive outside the body. If it comes visiting and you're on a healthy plant-based diet, your likelihood of having a severe course is quite significantly reduced. And that's true. There was a consistent finding in both of these studies.
And yet I have not heard that on any major media. So has it been going around? Has it been spread around, disseminated, discussed among those in public health?
Yeah. The first study that I mentioned, the one in healthcare workers, was actually published by the British Medical Journal team. I mean, it's an extremely credible study that was well received by the medical community. And I think people noticed it. But I think two things happened. One is it drowned in all the other coverage of COVID, getting vaccines, and the vaccines run out of gas, and all of these kinds of concerns came up. So it became a headline that turned into a fish wrapper really pretty quickly, unfortunately. The other thing comes up, I hate to say this, when people get bad news about their own diets, they don't particularly want to talk about it very much. And I have to say, I've been finding that we have been trying to push federal authorities, state and local authorities, to talk about healthier diets. Because ever since the beginning of the pandemic, we knew that if people would improve their diets, they would have a chance of reducing weight. That could save their life in COVID. Their diabetes could get under better control. That can save your life. But it's been an uphill battle, I have to say, to get the authorities to really talking about this.
You recently testified before the Council of the District of Columbia Committee on Health and co-authored a commentary in the American Journal of Medicine entitled Shoring Up Vaccine Efficacy. Describe that message.
It's just exactly what we've been talking about, that I'm here in Washington, D.C. And when we have looked around this city where I live, there are some economically advantaged areas. And in those areas, you see less COVID mortality, not just that. You see less colorectal cancer, you see less obesity, you see less diabetes. And then you see some economically disadvantaged parts of town where there aren't a lot of grocery stores. People don't eat in a very healthful way. The COVID mortality has been through the roof, as is diabetes, as is colorectal cancer, all of these kinds of things. So my message to my own city government here, which in defense of them, they were, like every other policymaking group, blindsided by this virus. And they were struggling to get people to wear masks, socially distance, and all these kinds of things. And our message was, do all of those things. Do all the public health things that you can do. But let's get a message out to the public that if you were ever thinking about improving your diet, now is the time to do it. Diabetes can kill you over decades in the best of times. But if the coronavirus comes knocking on your door, it can kill you in 14 days. So it's a time not only to eat well, but if you're on medicine and you've let your prescription lapse, now's the time to go to the pharmacist, talk to your doctor, make sure that you are in as good of health as you possibly can be. But the key part, the most important part of this, is in many ways the simplest. It's to let these healthy foods, like vegetables and fruits and beans and whole grains, work their magic in our bodies, which is to give us the antioxidants and the healthy energy without the cholesterol and fat and of all the chicken wings and roast beef and things that I grew up with, and many of your listeners did too.
So that's the simple message.
Yes.
Plant-based foods, unprocessed, and that's it.
But I think we have to go further. We have to not just ourselves do that. I think we should do that. But I have a message for my colleagues in the medical profession. When I go into the hospital, I see a beautiful display that could be Arby's. I mean, they have bacon on display and sausage and all of these kinds of foods on display, putting the imprimatur of the hospital behind these foods that we know now cause colorectal cancer and cause cardiovascular disease. So we've got to clean up our act and get serious about this. And that means helping our communities to eat in a more healthful way too. And it can be modeled in hospitals. It can be modeled in medical practice where doctors, instead of just talking about medications, actually learning about diet and prescribing it. For many doctors who weren't really trained in nutrition, which is pretty much all of us, it's a learning curve where they do have to learn how to make this work. But we are rewarded so much by being able to talk with patients about foods that can save their lives.
I think PCRM was involved in advocating for the closing of a McDonald's in a hospital. Is that accurate?
Quite a few of them, actually. The Golden Arches don't belong in a hospital.
No, they don't.
There have been quite a number of them. Hospitals have space. They lease it out. Sometimes people defend the McDonald's there. They say, well, at least you have something familiar to eat. And that was the same rationale for selling cigarettes in the gift shop. And the idea is, no, we're going to get rid of it.
Okay. So for people listening, they hear about preventing these diseases. They hear about some of these conditions, but they may not have a really good idea of what's behind the conditions in our bodies. What's actually going on? So I'll ask you to take some of the conditions, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, whatever you choose thereafter, and talk about the mechanisms in the body and why plant foods seem to be so protective and actually can help us reverse those diseases in many cases.
Sure. Before we leave COVID, though, let me just say one other thing about this. If people haven't already gotten the message that it's a darn good idea to eat our plant-based foods and to get away from the meat, there's one other aspect of this that came in. And that was, it really started the 4th of July. You may remember in the news, Provincetown, Massachusetts, big tourist mecca. A lot of people just descended on Provincetown, a whole bunch of people got sick. And what was remarkable wasn't that people who were crowded together in bars and stuff, that they would get COVID. What was remarkable was that a lot of them had been vaccinated. They'd been vaccinated, and we started to see these, what we called breakthrough cases. And now, of course, we see it all the time because vaccines, they don't last forever. But the question was, why do vaccines sometimes fail? Or why would it not work at all? Or why is it running out of gas rather quickly and not really protecting? So researchers published a really important study. They looked at healthcare workers. And these were healthcare workers who got the Pfizer vaccine. They'd all gotten a dose, then they got their follow-up dose. They're all protected. Everything's great. But then the researchers looked at who did not really get a very good response. And when I mean not a good response, you do a blood test and you see, did your body respond to the vaccine by making antibodies to the virus so you're protected? For some people, just really didn't happen very well. Why? The researchers took a tape measure, put it around everybody's waist. They asked them a question, do you smoke? They took their blood pressure. And this is just really simple research. And finally, they checked their cholesterol. And you know what they found? It's these conditions that make you more vulnerable to COVID also can defeat the vaccine to a degree. The heavier people were, the bigger their waistline, the more likely they were to have a bad response to the vaccine. Researchers said, we saw this with the flu. And this is true. If you are really heavy and you have a flu vaccine, your body doesn't mount as good of a response. And that's for two reasons. One is the real kind of simple-minded reason is that a vaccine works better if you get it in your muscle than if you get it subcutaneously. If you got a big thin skin and fat layer there, sometimes what you think is a muscular injection is actually just going into the fat. Doesn't work very well. But there's a bigger reason. The body adipose tissue itself is metabolically active and seems to interfere with vaccines. But smokers had a worse response. People with high blood pressure had a substantially lower response, and people with high cholesterol had a substantially lower response. So if you're getting the vaccine, by all means, do not stop at Arby's on the way. This is not a time to be eating those kinds of unhealthy foods, because we know that it not only makes the disease worse, but it makes the vaccines not work so well.
Yeah, that's something. That's something. I haven't heard about that.
Yeah. But you asked me about the cause of disease.
Yeah. And you can go into it just to give people a little bit of a background of what's going on, because most people hear diabetes and it's like, yeah, that's what everybody gets. It's just what happens. And heart disease. Yeah, it's just what happens. But what is actually happening in the body?
Well, let's take diabetes. Diabetes is not caused by eating bread. It's not caused by eating sugar. It's understandable people would think it is, because you go to the doctor and the doctor does a blood test and the doctor will say your sugar is high. And that sugar came from what you eat for the most part. You eat bread, it'll break apart to release sugar. The sugar gets in your blood and so your sugar is high. So we thought, well, the bread caused it. Had nothing to do with it. And I have to say that it took us a while to kind of figure this out. When I was a kid growing up in Fargo, North Dakota, my dad was the diabetes expert for the town. He worked at the Fargo Clinic, and everybody with diabetes came and saw my dad. And he'd get home from work about 6 or 6:30, and he'd set down his bag. And I never, ever heard him say that anybody with diabetes ever improved. It was just this kind of waiting game, where you would try to make the heart attack occur later. You try to make the damage to the eyes occur later, or maybe stop it from being so aggressive. And you try to reduce amputations. And nobody ever was able to throw their medicine away and not have diabetes anymore. And that's because we were looking at diet in all the wrong way. And patients were counseled, don't eat too much bread, don't eat too much sugar. And before my dad went to medical school, he worked on a cattle ranch. And that was actually the family business. And he didn't like it. And he left. He thought, forget this. I'm not raising cattle anymore. But we still ate like we were in the cattle business. And that was what we thought was normal. But our research said, wait a sec. Let's say, what if we stop eating animal products and keep oils really low? Let's see what happens. And what happens is diabetes improves dramatically. And sometimes it even goes away. Why would that be? People doing this are eating more bread. They're eating more rice. They're eating potatoes. They're doing all these kinds of things that we thought in the 1950s caused diabetes. Okay, here's the cause of diabetes. And here's how to make this make sense. Sugar, glucose, it's a good thing. When it gets into your blood, it goes into your muscle cells and it gives them power. It's your gasoline. It's what powers your muscles. Glucose does that. Every marathon runner knows that. They're carbo loading because they need glycogen, which is just stored glucose in their muscles. And so after about the second, third kilometer, they really want that glucose kicking in. Well, you need glucose just to get from here to the refrigerator. It is your fuel. How does it get into the muscle cells? Muscle cells don't allow it in. The only way that glucose can get inside your muscles is with a key, and that key is insulin. So the insulin is made in your pancreas. The insulin key goes through the blood, attaches to the surface of the muscle cell, opens it up, the glucose floods inside. Great. So I eat some bread. The bread releases glucose into my blood. The insulin opens the cell up. All the glucose goes out of the blood into the cell. Great. I have some rice. That will release healthy carbohydrate too. And the body says, great, that's more fuel. I can be strong now. And the insulin key lets that into the cell too. But I also ate a ham sandwich. And the ham had pig fat in it. And the mayonnaise had dairy fat and egg fat in it. And that fat, plus the cheese on top, 70% fat, the fat particles from the food ends up getting into the muscle cell too. And as the fat builds up more and more and more, insulin doesn't work anymore. The insulin key is on the surface of the cell, trying to open it up. The cell is jammed full of fat and it will not open. And so now you can eat bread and your blood sugar will rise because the sugar isn't getting into the cells. So the cause of type 2 diabetes is the buildup of fat inside muscle cells and also liver cells that is causing your insulin to fail. A vegan diet doesn't have any animal fat in it at all. And if I keep oils low, that fat that's built up inside your cells starts to dissipate. It starts to go away. And then we start to see something that my dad never saw. That's diabetes improving and people not needing so much insulin, maybe not at all. And in some cases, for all intents and purposes, the disease is gone. And when I first saw that a couple of decades ago in patients in our research studies, I have to tell you, it was an exciting moment. I was taught in medical school. I went to one of the best medical schools in the country. I was taught that diabetes does not go away. Once you've got diabetes, you'll always have diabetes. And that was said for good reasons, because we wanted our patients to take it seriously. Don't just neglect your doctor's appointments. This is a serious disease. You've got to care for yourself every day. But then we started seeing people who didn't have diabetes anymore. They made big diet changes and their insulin sensitivity came back like they were 16 years old. And so instead of being a one-way street, it was a two-way street. You can get rid of this disease.
And Dr. Barnard,
the idea that it's caused by carbohydrate, it's not.
Right. And we have a great example of this turnaround in diabetes with someone who is now very well known in New York. He was on this show about a year ago, and he talked about that he woke up one day and he couldn't see his alarm clock. And so he went to doctors and they told him he would have this thing called diabetes like everybody else had. Well, it turns out he then went to a Whole Foods plant-based diet doctor, and his condition was stopped, reversed, his eyesight came back, and now he is a vocal proponent of a Whole Foods plant-based diet. And his name is Eric Adams, the new mayor-elect of New York, New York City. So it's getting to people who are in the public eye. So it's been kind of a hidden secret amongst just those of us who are, you know, telling the people that we can tell. It's really getting out there now from what I can see.
It really is. And I want to praise the mayor-elect. He has done a wonderful job in really getting the word out and saying, sharing his own experience so that other people can get the same kind of result.
Yeah, a vocal proponent. He's a great spokesperson. Do you want to say a few words about cardiovascular disease?
Let me tip my hat to Dr. Dean Ornish, who showed that a plant-based diet, not only will it not clog your muscle cells, it won't clog your arteries.
A long time ago,
30 years ago.
Yeah.
He showed that the arteries open up enough that you could see a measurable difference in 82% of patients in his Lancet trial published in 1990. And this was without statins, without any medication at all. And it was really quite remarkable.
Getting away from COVID and the conditions, there was another interesting study that I read on your page that showed that a plant-based diet rich in soy had a huge beneficial impact on moderate to severe hot flashes. Talk a bit about that.
Yeah, a lot of women have hot flashes. You're 50, 52, and you reach menopause. And menopause, it's not a disease. It's not the end of life. It just means that Mother Nature says, this is not the time for you to have a toddler on your kitchen floor. The reproductive window is closed. We got other things to do in life. And many women sail through menopause with no problem, but some do have hot flashes. And what the condition is vasodilation. It just means that the blood vessels in your skin very quickly open up and they release heat into your skin. So it's like suddenly it's 150 degrees. Problem is you're in a board of directors meeting and you're trying to look composed and speak to the other people. And suddenly you feel like a strawberry on fire. And it can happen at night and it can happen many times at night. And you wake up in a sweat and you change your pajamas and it happens a couple hours again. And you just, your quality of life is just tanked. And then where it gets really bad is when you go to see the doctor. And so many doctors still will say, I've got a great prescription for you. We're calling it HRT. It's hormone replacement therapy. And take this and your hot flashes will be gone. And that's true. I mean, it's really effective. But a woman taking HRT before she swallows her first pill will go online and say, where is this from? And if the brand is Premarin, very, very popular brand. She'll say, what's Premarin? And the origin of the term Premarin is pregnant mare's urine. Mares are impregnated. And by the way, this is not done with Barry Manilow records and roses and chocolate. I mean, this is not voluntary. When they are pregnant, their body changes and they start excreting a lot of estrogen. And the estrogen is in their urine. And so ranchers are paid to collect their urine and it's packed into these pills and sold as Premarin. So it's pregnant mare's urine in a concentrated pill. And that's what you're swallowing. And then the other part of it is that you look online and you discover that there are a huge number of side effects that are put in bold print at the very top of the instructions page, what they call the package insert. Breast cancer, endometrial cancer, stroke, blood clots, myocardial infarction, that's a heart attack, dementia. The woman goes back to her doctor and says, I don't think I want to take this. And the doctor will say, don't worry about it. You know, as long as you stop in 5-10 years, you can probably be okay. Research study came out in 2019 that said that for all the women who are on this treatment for 10 years or more, because it's sold chronically, because your hot flashes come back when you stop. For every 25 women who take that medicine for 10 years or more, one of the 25 is going to get breast cancer as a result of the doctor's treatment. And others will have heart attacks and other kinds of conditions. So it's a serious issue. All right. With that big preamble, what's the better way? In Japan, in the 1980s, researchers started interviewing women and they discovered they didn't have a word for hot flashes because they didn't have them. Maybe 15% of women had something like a hot flash. It was kind of a warm flash. It wasn't a big deal. Then when Japan modified its diet from a mostly rice-based diet to a burger centric diet, because McDonald's arrived in Tokyo, hot flashes went up to about 40%. Okay, bingo. What is this about? To make a really long story short, researchers discovered two things. Number one, people on plant-based diets tend to have an advantage, whether they're in Tokyo or in rural Mexico. But soybeans have what are called isoflavones that have an anti-hot flash effect, as well as having an anti-cancer effect. So our research team, actually, forgive me for how long this story is. I've got to make it just slightly longer. I wrote this book called Your Body in Balance that came out about in the spring of 2020. It's all about how you can control hormones by food. And there's a big menopause chapter in it. And a woman named Betty McEwen contacted me. And she said, I read your menopause chapter. I did what you said. And my hot flashes were gone within 5 days. Wow, that's amazing. I thought it would help, but I didn't think it would help that fast. So I asked her to tell me exactly what she did, because I described a vegan diet and cutting fat out and having soy. But she said, I did it in a particular way. Exactly vegan, no cheating. Very low in fat, no cheating on that either. And she had a half a cup of mature soybeans every day, Laura brand non-GMO soybeans, bought from Amazon and cooked in her Instant Pot. And so I wrote all this down. And when she told me this, a light bulb went off in my head. And I ran into the head of my research team's office and I said, I think I got it. Edamame is the baby soybean. If you leave it on the vine for a little longer and let it mature, it has a lot more isoflavones in it. And if you turn it into soy milk, you could have maybe 2 quarts of it to get a good dose of isoflavones. But just a half a cup of the mature non-GMO soybeans is a really high source of isoflavones. So that, bingo, we're going to do a study. We brought in women who had pretty bad hot flashes. And we found that this diet works really well. It knocked out the moderate to severe hot flashes by 84%. And a lot of women just didn't have them anymore. It was absolutely life-changing. Sexual symptoms of menopause for many women improved. We weren't expecting these things. The point is that with this very simple non-drug solution, not only could women really tackle their hot flashes, the average woman lost 8 pounds in 12 weeks. And you're set up for so many other benefits. All the side effects are good. Weight loss, blood pressure coming down, cholesterol coming down. Women who had GERD, you know, heartburn, got better in many, many cases, and energy is better. So anyway, we've been really trying to bang the drum for it. And I have to say, I don't know that the medical community likes to talk about menopause because they want to sell you something. They would much rather sell you HRT as opposed to a natural solution to it. But we think that the natural approach, which is plant-based diet, low fat, have soybeans if you want, is really the way to go.
Those are some powerful results. This is Bob DiBenedetto on WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook. We're talking to Dr. Neil Barnard, an adjunct professor of medicine at the George Washington University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C., and president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, or PCRM. They're at pcrm.org. And lest we leave male anatomy out of this discussion, PCRM recently started a campaign of bus ads in Washington, D.C. called Ditch Dairy to Protect Your Prostate. Talk a bit about that.
Yeah, prostate cancer is extremely common. I was taught in medical school, all men get it if you just live long enough. It's not exactly true, but it is very, very, very common. And for some men, it's not so bad. It advances very slowly. For others, it's a killer. And back more than two decades ago, Harvard University researchers did a really important study. The study was called the Health Professionals. The Health Professionals follow-up study, and before that, the Physicians Health Study. Two big studies. They were following up on observations that milk-drinking men were at higher risk of prostate cancer. Nobody knew why exactly. Men in Japan, very low risk. Milk, not a big part of their diet. Men in America, Finland, Sweden, really high risk. So they decided, let's look within America at men who consume a lot of milk and men who don't. And those who consume the most milk had a 34% increased risk. So we know that it's real. And then the Health Professionals follow-up study, same result. And in about 2016, a meta-analysis combined the results of about 11 prior studies, and it's really very consistent. We think what's happening is that your body is reacting like a calf. Calf drinks milk from mom. The calf's body, in response to the milk, starts making something called IGF-1, insulin-like growth factor. Causes the calf to grow. If there are prostate cancer cells in your body, it causes them to grow. So milk is like fertilizer on wheat. And men don't know that. Hmm. They have been told by their well-meaning, ill-informed doctors, dietitians, others, to drink milk. It does them absolutely no good, and it will increase their risk of prostate cancer. So anyway, our job is to get the word out, and that's what those ads are about.
Okay. The results in the studies that you're mentioning are not 2% here, 3% here, 5% here. They're all very powerful statements, the results that you're coming up with. It's quite something.
That's right. And a 34% increased risk of something that's rare is not huge. But a 34% increased risk of prostate cancer, which is really common, is big. And imagine if we can reduce the risk by that proportion. That's what we're trying to do.
Indeed. All right, let's shift to the topic of the day, another topic of the day, which is the upcoming holiday, Thanksgiving. And since the holiday season is upon us and it's all about food, whenever we think about Thanksgiving, we think about food. I haven't had turkey or animal products in my diet since 1978. So when I think of Thanksgiving, I don't think of turkey and I don't miss eating it. But for those who are just starting to consider moving away from eating all the animals that they're eating, and have heard what they've heard today, the thought of moving, of changing, can be scary, since they think that they'll have to change everything about everything that they do, and nothing will ever be the same, and they're going to have to suffer. So PCRM has at pcrm.org/Thanksgiving, a free Thanksgiving e-cookbook with more than 20 plant-based holiday recipes, from appetizers to main dishes, side dishes, and desserts. That's pcrm.org/Thanksgiving. And you're, I know, someone who promotes the fact that you need not give everything up. You need not do away with everything, but you can just simply modify what you've been doing all these years. Talk a bit about that.
Well, you know, kids gather around the table and it's Thanksgiving. And you know, the thing that they're digging into the most, frankly, it's not the turkey. They go for the stuffing.
I'm one of those kids.
You know what I'm talking about. And the turkey has become this unfortunate tradition. But everything around the turkey can be made in a healthy way. Now, the stuffing can be made with butter, and the sweet potatoes can be made with butter and grease and so forth. But it's the easiest thing in the world to make these in a healthy way. So what I would suggest people do is make that, you know, say the butternut squash soup. It's fall. What a beautiful thing to start your lunch or dinner with. And you can have the sweet potatoes and you can have the greens and you can have the stuffings and you can have all these things. And if you really want to have fun with it, get yourself a tofurkey and you'll have conversation for a really long period of time about it. Some people can make fun of it if they want to, and that's okay. But some people might taste it and they'll think, okay, that's a little bit of an all right. And the rest of the conversation is going to go in a really good way, which is the kids or the teenagers are going to say, why do we kill turkeys? Turkeys are really nice animals. You know, you look at a baby, there's nothing cuter than a little baby, awkward little turkey. And you think, I don't want you to grow up to be, have your head like removed and be on my dinner table. And then somebody else in the family start fighting about it. And that's a healthy thing for people to start talking about what a goofy culture that we've got into, where we give thanks for the abundance of the year by stuffing ourselves with even more. I'm one of these people who thinks Thanksgiving ought to be a time to have a good, nice, filling meal, a healthy meal that doesn't take anybody's life, and then go somewhere and do something decent for somebody else so that you're actually giving thanks. I think we can do that. And, you know, in medicine, it's one of the few professions where we haven't forgotten ethics. Every medical student is taught this little command, really. First, do no harm. The idea is you're going to go into a patient's home. You've got medicines, you've got things that you can do, but first, just don't hurt anybody. And that's really good advice for other aspects of our life. So when I was in medical school, I was asked to take a patient. In the second year of medical school, the patient walked on four legs. The patient was a dog. And we all were given dogs. And you take the dog and tape the dog to a table. And you inject the dog with norepinephrine and you record that his pulse increases. And then you inject the dog with propranolol and you show his pulse goes down. And then you follow the instruction to exsanguinate your dog, which means to slowly drain the blood out of the dog's body. And then the pulse stops. And the students all look around at each other. And they said, did I just kill my dog? And an hour later, they're going to be at home. There's a big line of trash bags all up and down the hallway of the medical school. And the medical students are at home explaining to their wife, their husband, their partner, their friend, their parents, that they just killed their first patient. Now, I was not a cocky, courageous medical student, but when that lab was scheduled, I told my instructor that I was not going to be participating. I said, I'm not going to do that. And he said, I'm not asking you. This is a requirement. But there was a student next to me, and she said, he's not doing it. I'm not doing it either. And so then we had a movement of two people, and we decided to get rid of those. And as you know, once we started the physicians committee, we did get rid of those. We got rid of the dog labs at every medical school, and not just dog labs, animal labs are all gone from every medical school in the United States and Canada. They won't even offer it anymore because of this work. But here's my point. What was that about? Yes, it was because it's bad teaching. I mean, why am I teaching you, trying to teach you human medicine by killing a dog? We should be able to apprentice looking at the human body and that kind of thing. But the main reason to not do this is because it's unethical. And in this profession, we can remember that ethics actually counts for something. In America, we're embarrassed to be ethical. It's sort of tantamount to weakness. But let me say the strongest thing you can do is to say, I'm not going to be part of some kind of pointless exercise that involves suffering and taking a life. I don't have to be. And so Thanksgiving is one of those times where this topic comes up. And I don't mean to point a finger at anybody who hasn't kind of figured it out yet. What I do mean to say that this discussion is the greatest discussion we could ever have, because now is the time when there is so much conflict in the world, whether it's political discourse or just people on the street, to be able to bring back the idea of caring for other people, caring for the earth that we're in, caring for the animals that we share it with. That's a darn good thing.
It certainly is. And there's no downside to it. And I think something that's happening today, which has not happened thus far, is that people are starting to see that with the options out there that tastes the same as the animal that they used to be eating. And as they make these better nutritionally, as we go down the road, better and better as years go by, because it's been created, it can be made from anything we want them to be made from. We're all confronted with the question of whether we want to continue this activity, even though we will not be losing that taste that we've become accustomed to, that taste and that animal that our parents taught was quite fine to eat. Because to do it when we have no choice is one thing. To do it when there is a choice, and we know that if we do continue to do it, there is suffering and death. I mean, it's just, there's no way around it. Suffering and death involved. It's creating a different question in society's minds. And I've seen it interestingly discussed on everything from talk shows to the financial channel. So that discussion that you raised many, many years ago related to experimentation on animals is seeping into the larger society in, I think, a very, very big way and accelerated over the last few years. Indeed.
And I think that's right. And part of it is because we now have possibilities we didn't have before. Back in the 1950s, the idea was you needed meat for health. I mean, people thought that, and they thought if you didn't have meat, you wouldn't get protein, you wouldn't get iron. And so it wasn't really a question. You knew that the animals were suffering, but you thought you had really no choice. And researchers clearly showed pretty soon that you actually do better by leaving the animal off your plate. So the fact that you do have a choice now allows this discussion to happen.
All right, indeed. All right, so that brings us to the end of the interview time. What I'm going to do now is turn it over to Catherine Congdon, and she's going to read to you some questions from the audience.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bernard. This has just been so inspirational. And thanks for all that you've done. We all feel that way about it. And it's wonderful to be here with you and hear you live like this. So starting with this question, even though I've been vegan and following a whole foods plant-based diet for 13 years, my cholesterol is high. Do you have an explanation and any recommendations?
You might have to blame your parents for that one. For 90% of people, it's really under dietary control. For about 1 in 10, genes do kind of raise their ugly head. And what I mean is there are some people where genetically their bodies are making more cholesterol. And there's only one way to know. And that is to avoid animal products completely. And also keep oily foods really low. Now, you said you're on a whole food plant-based diet. That means different things to different people. I would suggest you have lots of beans, grains, vegetables, fruits, but don't have oily stuff, nuts, seeds, even avocados. Keep all fatty foods really low for about 8 weeks, because now there's no cholesterol in your diet, almost no saturated fat. And then get your cholesterol tested. If it hadn't budged, then it's genetic. And does that mean you're at risk for heart disease? I don't know. The point I was making, vegan, very low in fat, 8 weeks, get tested. If you haven't budged, then it's genetic. But take heart. Dr. Dean Ornish showed years ago that I remember one of the participants in his study could not get his cholesterol down. It was obviously genetic, but even he had reversal of his heart disease. Now, you see your doctor, you got a high cholesterol, you've changed your diet, it's still high. Virtually every doctor you see is going to say, if I were you, I would take a statin. And that's kind of where the discussion is. Nobody really knows what's right.
Okay, great. Thank you. Here's a question. What are the best plant foods for strong, healthy bones?
Well, you do need calcium, as everybody knows, but you don't need dairy calcium. In fact, cows don't make calcium. You can't make an element. They eat calcium. Calcium is in the ground. And the calcium goes through the roots of the grass into the blade of grass. The cow eats it, and some of that calcium gets in their milk. Let's say you take the middleman out and don't eat grass, but do eat the plants that you would like to eat. So not grass, but kale and collard greens and broccoli and Brussels sprouts and so forth. That's where the calcium is. Green plants pull it out of the soil and they offer it to you at the produce counter and make that an abundant part of your diet. So you do need that. You need to absorb the calcium. So that's vitamin D. Vitamin D comes from the sun. If you're in Washington where I am now, and it's about 35 degrees, you're probably not getting any sun. So either move to the equator or take a vitamin D supplement. 2000 IUs a day is a pretty good amount. And give your bones a reason to live. And that means put on your sneakers and go out and run, jog, walk around, lift weights, stress your bones with healthy exercise. And that's really a pretty good combination.
Great. another question. You suggested soybeans for menopause, but so much info states soy can cause cancer.
Soy does exactly the opposite. But you're it's understandable that this myth has just, for some reason, gone on and on and on and on. And you can kind of understand why that myth would have started. Decades ago, researchers discovered that soybeans contain isoflavones, these magical compounds, daidzein, genistein, glycine. And they started studying them. And they discovered that the isoflavones could attach to estrogen receptors. And that started this mythology that because they could attach to a receptor, they might cause cancer. But then researchers started looking at, do people who eat soy have more breast cancer? And they don't. They have about 30% less breast cancer risk. And back in 2008, a meta-analysis combined the results of 8 prior studies, and women consuming the most soy had about 30% reduced risk of developing breast cancer. And then another study, more than 11,000 women, showed that those women who had had cancer in the past, but now ate a lot of soy, they were protected against dying of their cancer by about 30% also. It reduced mortality by about 30%. So soy does exactly the opposite of this myth. But you're right, the myth is around. People think soy, doesn't that cause cancer? It does exactly the opposite. The people at the highest risk of breast cancer are people who avoid soy. So the kicker came in when researchers discovered one more thing. And that's that there are 2 broad categories of estrogen receptors. Estrogen receptor alpha is like the gas pedal. And estradiol in Premarin, for example, or that your body makes, attaches to the estrogen receptor alpha. And that is like the gas pedal on cancer. But the other category of estrogen receptors are called estrogen receptor beta. And that's where the isoflavones preferentially attach. And think of that as the brake. So no, soy doesn't cause cancer any more than your foot makes your car go faster. It depends on whether your foot is on the gas or your foot is on the brake. Soy is the brake.
To continue that question, where do you get mature soy?
Nowadays, you wonder, is there maturity anywhere? But there's this little known website. It's spelled AMAZ. Oh, and go on Amazon and put in soybeans, and they've got 16 different brands. They will sell you a mature soybean. That just means a soybean, basic whole soybeans. If you want to, I'm gonna tell you how you make them. Throw them in your Instant Pot or pressure cooker, cook them for 40 minutes, and then they come out like pine nuts. Throw them in your salad or throw them in a soup. But for extra credit, you can do one more step. Put them on a baking sheet. Use some parchment paper so they don't stick. Throw them in the oven, 350 degrees for an hour. When they come out, if they're nice and dry, they are now toasted. And if they are really thoroughly dry, they will sit in your desk drawer as a snack. And a half cup either way works. And if you think life is too short for me to toast soybeans, go back on AMAZON and say, I want toasted soybeans that somebody else toasted for me. And they're called Toasteds, T-O-S-T-E-D. And they'll ship them to your house. You'll probably have them tomorrow. But I would suggest fall in love with cooking again. Try doing some of this yourself, because when you do, you can flavor them in all different kinds of fun ways. And you could show your kids how to do that too.
What is the best argument against the keto diet and for a plant-based diet this person wants to convince their sister?
Good luck with that, because keto diet has now acquired the status of a religion, where when you talk to somebody about the ketogenic diet, it's kind of a crazy diet. It says to lose weight, you should avoid carbohydrates, including apples. Don't eat an apple. Don't eat a banana. Don't eat grapes. Don't eat peaches. Don't eat all the healthiest foods. Don't eat sweet potatoes. Don't eat regular potatoes. Don't eat rice. Da, 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 da. And people will lose weight in that way. And that's why they swear by it. But the reason that they lose weight is that carbohydrates are about 50 or 60% of what a person eats in a day. And if you take out any 50 or 60% of your food, you are definitely going to lose weight. The problem is they take away the healthiest part. And if you are then left with meat and gravy and that kind of thing, what happens to your cholesterol? Well, normally when people starve themselves and their weight comes down, their cholesterol level will fall. And that will happen to some keto people. But for a lot of them, the meat stuff that's left over causes their bad cholesterol to rise, sometimes very rapidly to very high levels. So reason number one is it's just such an unhealthy thing to do for your body. Reason number two is that the foods that are left are the very foods that are linked to colorectal cancer and to Alzheimer's disease. So a person who follows this for a long time are the people that we're most concerned about. Reason number three is that you're violating all the other reasons for going vegan. Like you're eating the most obviously anti-environmental, anti-compassionate diet. Some people have tried to do this by saying, okay, I won't do it with meat. I'll do keto vegan. So I'm not gonna eat any carbohydrates. All I'm gonna eat is guacamole and fatty stuff or peanut butter. Don't do that. Keep in mind, the skinniest, longest lived people on the planet in recent decades were people in Japan before the diet westernized. They were eating phenomenal amounts of carbohydrate, rice, white rice, noodles. They were very thin because carbohydrate has only 4 calories in every gram compared to fat, which has 9. So you can eat healthy carbohydrates. Check out the meat products. Check out the added greasy junk, and you can lose weight as well as a person does on keto, but all the side effects are good. You're now on an anti-cancer diet, an anti-heart disease diet, an anti-Alzheimer's disease diet, and plus it's being a compassionate diet too.
Great. Thank you for that, Dr. Barnard. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we draw our show to a close?
Just 2 things. One is thank you for spreading the word as you are, and a request that everybody who's listening to this, if you're finding these things to be new, we have to not be quiet. We have to share what we know with other people. So whether it's a book or a website or a DVD or a movie link or something like that, let's make some noise. And if we do that, you'll never know how many lives you save, but I guarantee it will be quite a lot. So thank you for letting me talk with you tonight.
It's been a real pleasure having you again. So many of us have admired your work and what you've done for decades. Several decades. And that is something that you've stuck with it all this time. So thank you.
We're not done yet. This is
no. Nope.
there's plenty left to do. So
let's see
how far we can go.
Absolutely. All right. We've been talking to Dr. Neil Barnard, MD, an adjunct professor of medicine at the George Washington University School of Medicine in Washington, D.C., and president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. You can find out everything about them at PCRM. Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, PCRM.org. And for those whose interest has been piqued by the information we've discussed, they have a couple of very interesting resources, as well as a lot of research and news stories, and you will find a lot on their website. But if you don't know where to start, they have a 21-day vegan kickstart program, and that you'll find on their site. Also at PCRM.org/Thanksgiving, you will find that you're able to download a free Thanksgiving e-cookbook with more than 20 plant-based holiday recipes. This is Bob DiBenedetto, and that does it for this edition of the Healthy Planet radio program on WUSB 90.1 FM, Stony Brook, New York. I'll be with you again at the same time on December 3rd, and every month thereafter at 6 p.m. on the first 2 Fridays of the month. And when I'm not here, be sure to listen to Natural Alternatives and the Healthy Planet shows every week at this time with great hosts sharing cutting-edge health and environmental information. For more information on Healthy Planet and our radio shows, or if you'd like to be part of our live studio audience, visit our website at www.healthyplanetusa.org. And don't forget to pledge. Pledging keeps this station alive, and you know the valuable programming that we have and that we've had on this show for 15 years and on WUSB for many decades before that. Call 631-632-6901, 631-632-6901, or pledge online at wusb.fm, wusb.fm. $20,000 is our goal. We need you to reach it. Until next time, stay strong, relax, be kind to those around you, including our amazing 2 or multi-legged friends. And finally, remember to enjoy this beautiful world and holiday season that we will all share. Good night.
Our climate is changing. Making a few changes to your driving habits can cut tailpipe emissions and improve fuel efficiency. Drive smart. Go easy on the brakes and gas pedal. Get regular tune-ups by following your vehicle's maintenance schedule. Check your tire pressure. Combine as many activities and errands into one trip as possible. Reduce your carbon impact to the environment. Act now on climate change.
A stay in the hospital for people of all ages can be a stressful and challenging experience. But every day, teams of volunteers in UCLA's People Animal Connection, or PAC, make the lives of patients and their families better.
You see the patients get happier and more relaxed. They kind of forget that they're in a hospital bed.
The visits are provided to hospitalized patients without cost. Learn how you can get involved at uclahealth.org/PAC.